Dr. Perry Phillips.
I'm afraid it's going to be more towards the end of the talk before we find how exactly we're going to enjoy reading Joshua. I will not read through it, but basically the principles that I hope to give today as to how one goes about finding biblical sites, I hope will be helpful in spurting you on to reading sections like Joshua, basically chapter 13 through about 20, 21, because those are the sections that usually we skip over. Because we have all the list of names, city after city after city, border upon border, line upon line, precept upon precept. And as the list of all those cities, we come across those, usually we tend to go on to the more spiritual material rather than dwell on that particular material. And yet, this is precisely where the historical geographer likes to start. Historical geographers like that kind of material very much, the list of cities, because it helps them in a list like that to be able to locate where indeed the cities are located. Basically then, my aim in this particular talk, as I said, is general, how to find biblical sites, but also there's going to be a certain propaganda value to the talk as well, and that is to hope to spur people on into looking more seriously into the whole subject of historical geography, and to look more seriously into maps and atlases and helps that are available to help one understand where the historical, where the plane board, where the history was actually carried out. For example, if you take a look at 2 Chronicles 11, and you look at the material about Rehoboam's fortresses, again, you have a list of cities there. And we can lose a lot of material by not actually looking at where those cities are located. We read Rehoboam fortified this city, that city, the other city. If we look at a map, we can actually find where those cities that Rehoboam fortified, where they were located, and we see that they were right along main routes. And they were precisely the kind of cities and the places of the cities that would be fortified if we were king. And we look at what Rehoboam did, and we sit back and we say, well, he was a very fine general. He had quite a bit of general ability to be able to fortify those cities. But on the other hand, as a result of going away from the Lord, Shishak, Pharaoh of Egypt, came and wiped out Judah for the most part anyway. And how much deeper than the spiritual lesson that the Lord was trying to teach Rehoboam, the fact that he should depend upon the Lord and not depend solely upon his fortified cities. And looking at the geographical material a little more closely brings out the spiritual lesson a little more closely. And these are the kind of things that I have found as a result of studying historical geography. And as I said, part of this talk hopefully will be to spur you on to do the same thing. And then finally, the third aim of the talk is going to be to introduce you to some of the tricks of the trade, and that is precisely what are the materials available for doing historical geography. I will hopefully introduce you to some of those things today, in case you want to continue on in your own study. Along with the outline has been handed an annotated bibliography to help those who want to go on with some further reading. So, part two then, the disciplines of historical geography, and I have there an overview. Basically, what I want to do is put a diagram on the board. There are four disciplines of historical geography. Again, looking at the history of the Bible in its geographical location. This is what we mean by historical geography. Not only learning the spiritual lessons behind what occurred, but looking precisely where these actions that we find in the Scripture did occur. And we have to realize that the Scripture, about 90% of what we read in the Scripture, occurred in a certain place and time. And the permanent value of the Scripture, the spiritual lessons of the Scripture, come out more deeply when we then more deeply understand what the plane board was all about. And this is what we mean about historical geography, by the term historical geography, where it all occurred. And if I just put down a diagram here, I'll start with a diagram and I will end with a diagram too, after the other material has been presented. Here's the subject, historical geography, and there are actually four disciplines to it. First discipline, over here, history. As you might imagine, history, and this looks into the various sources that where we find the historical material presented, primarily the Bible, the biblical material, but also a great number of non-biblical sources which help us understand the biblical material. This is the number one source of anything that we do with historical geography. Second thing, that we look at, geography, ties into the study of historical geography, not only what occurred, but where it occurred. Third topic, or the third discipline of historical geography, is what is known as toponymy. Toponymy, T-O-P-O-N-Y-M-Y. Basically, toponymy is just the study of place names. How the name of these locations are transmitted through time from one generation to the other, from one peoples to another, from one language to another. And then finally, the fourth discipline to historical geography is archaeology, where we look at the material remains. And a historical geographer, in order to get a valid picture and an overall accurate picture of the plane board, has to be familiar with all four of these particular disciplines. And as a result, a historical geographer spends a lot of time learning not only the language of the Bible, but the language of external sources, the location, toponymy, names, basically studying Arabic to see how the Arabic names display the Hebrew names, and then also archaeology to be able to get a sequence of material remains to tie into the whole, to all of this material. So taking these things then individually, basically in terms of importance, I've listed them in terms of importance. First of all, historical sources, the study of historical sources, also called philology. Normally we think of philology as just the study of terms, different terms in the Bible, and the study of words. But I'm using philology in the general sense of the study of the biblical material, the study of the source material. And I've broken it up into primary sources and into secondary sources. First of all, the primary source, of course, is the biblical material, because this is what we're primarily interested in. We're interested in historical geography of the land of Israel. So we take the biblical material as the primary source. And in the biblical material, you find the biblical material arranged basically into three categories, which I've listed here. This material basically comes out of Aharoni's book. I'm using the sequence here that he uses. I've mentioned this in the bibliography. I'll be throwing these books up in the course of the talk. And also I've mentioned some things in the bibliography concerning them. This is The Land of the Bible, A Historical Geography by Yohanan Aharoni. This particular book is an introduction, but it also assumes a certain bit of knowledge of history of the land of Israel, or at least a good bit of familiarity with the biblical material in order to understand what is being given here. And he takes it not only from the biblical material, but from the non-biblical material as well. He divides the material as follows: historical, geographical. For example, Genesis 10, the table of nations, gives us an idea of how the nation of Israel thought of itself as the center of the surrounding nations. This would be under the category of historical geographical. Also, the list of conquered kings that you find in Joshua is another historical geographical list. Joshua 12, for example, some of you will be getting to that. The land which remains, the third category under historical geographical. This you find in Joshua 13 and also in Judges 3, the land which remains. In Joshua 13, it's the land which remains to be divided among the tribes. Again, a list and border regions that help the historical geographer. And in Judges chapter 3, the land to be conquered, those areas which the Israelites were not able to drive out the inhabitants of the land when they came in. And this is also given to us in Judges. And then also you have, for example, in Numbers 33, kind of an itinerary of the wandering Israelites as they went through the desert. There's another kind of historical geographical list that we find in the scripture. By far the most useful kinds of lists are beta and gamma under biblical, the administrative territorial lists. And there are a number of these that you find in the scripture itself. Also, for example, 1 Kings 4, verses 7 through 19. 1 Kings 4, 7 through 19. This is basically Solomon's list of districts as he divided the country into the various districts. The reason this is helpful is because when you know where the district is, then you can pinpoint the cities far more accurately than if you're looking over just a wide area of a city, let's say in Judah. If you know that Judah was divided into 12 provinces or 6 provinces, and you can look at the provinces and try to figure out where they were located, then it narrows down one's ability to locate these specific cities. You also have, along with Solomon's list, border list, boundary list, etc., various town lists. And Joshua, for example, this isn't in Solomon's time, but in Joshua, when you look at the division of the land of Judah and a border description of the land of Judah, you find two kind of lists. One is kind of a point-by-point list from city to city to city. And this is very useful because if you know where a couple cities are located, then you know the other ones are located in between. When it says the border, for example, from Jericho went up to Ai over to Bethel, then went to the hill opposite Beit Horon, or something like this, you can, again, you have a line, kind of a point-by-point description. And you may not know where all of those sites are, but if at least you know where a few of those sites are, you can then pick out the in-between sites with the methods that I'll bring up a little later. And aside from the point-by-point description, you also have kind of a city list that is given. For example, Joshua 15, a city list of the inherited towns of Judah, which again helps you pinpoint things and refer things, boil things down to a certain region. And then the third kind of biblical list that you find are expeditions and conquests. A couple passages on that, which help us find some very important cities up to the north, and also tells us of one of the main invasion routes into the country, is found in 1 Kings 15:20. This is when Ben-Hadad of Syria comes down, and he says, Ben-Hadad agreed with King Asa and sent the commanders of his forces against the town of Israel. He conquered Ijon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Maacah, and all Kinneret, in addition to Naphtali. And by looking at these particular cities, we know it's along a major invasion route coming in from the north. And as we go and we look at the area geographically and try to find the various sites in these regions, we again are helped in being able to locate them. And when the same cities are mentioned on a couple invasion lists, for example, 2 Kings 15, very sad time in the history of Israel when Tiglath-Pileser came down. 2 Kings 15:29 says, in the time of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came down and took, again, the same cities, Ijon, Abel-Beth-Maacah, Yanoah, Kadesh, and Hazor. He took Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and deported the people to Assyria. Again, these kind of lists help us locate areas, locate avenues of approach into the country, and they become an area of prime expedition for the historical geographer to look at. But not only do we have the primary sources, we also have the primary biblical sources, we also have a number of non-biblical sources as well, and a number of these are given in Pritchard's work, which I've mentioned in the bibliography, basically material that comes to us from Egypt, invaders coming up from Egypt. For example, the conquest of Thutmose III, Amenhotep II, very famous Egyptian pharaohs who bragged about their exploits as they came into Israel. And in their temples at Karnak, you find these lists and a number of other places as well. And this then also helps locate sites in the land of Israel even before the Israelites came into the land. You also find a number of invasion lists. So the Assyrian kings that came in, the Babylonian kings that came in from Mesopotamia, these particular lists are also extremely useful. You also have in the archaeological excavations quite a number of ostraca that are found, or potsherds that have writing on them, which also give us information, geographical information. I'm thinking specifically of the Lachish letters, the so-called Lachish letters, the Arad letters, the Samaria ostraca. And the historical geographer sees this material as primary source material in order to locate the various sites, and hence becomes familiar with that particular material as much as possible. Not only does the primary material help us, but also there's quite a bit of secondary material, which is extremely useful as well. First of all, Josephus, that I've mentioned here. Josephus lived right about the time of the apostles and writes us a history of the Jews. And in his history, he gives us quite a bit of material of the geographical and political makeup of the land of Israel in the time of the New Testament period. And hence, he, in a sense, is not only primary material for that period of time, but Josephus also relates to us quite a bit of Old Testament history and mentions the locations given to us in the Bible and also gives us a clue as to where they're located or where at least he thought they were located in his time. And for that reason, Josephus becomes, as I say, a secondary source, but a very close source, much closer to the time of the writing of the biblical material than we are. So Josephus is important in that respect. You also find in the Jewish literature, the Talmud and the Mishnah, you find quite a bit of material concerning geography, where Rabbi so-and-so is speaking to Rabbi this and that, discussing a site where such and such a place would be located. And the rabbi says, well, if you walk a few miles down this road, you will come by this particular tell, which is next to this place and the other place. And again, that becomes material which is useful for locating biblical sites, because a number of these rabbis were also interested in the location of the events of the Old Testament period. And then probably the most helpful secondary source is Eusebius with Jerome's remarks. Eusebius lived around 260 to 335 A.D., and Eusebius not only came into the land with Helena, who was the mother of Constantine, to find the original cross and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, 260 to 335 A.D. He not only comes into the land with Helena to find the actual place of the crucifixion, and helped locate some of these areas and build churches in these areas, Eusebius left us the so-called onomasticon, O-N-O-M-A-S-T-I-C-O-N, right. The onomasticon, unfortunately, there's no English version of it. It's in Greek. And if you want a translation of it, the translation is either in Hebrew or in German, and probably the latter being a little easier. But all it is, this happens to be the Hebrew translation of it, all it is a list of cities and where they are located. Eusebius, in that particular time, tried to do what the historical geographer does today, and that is find biblical sites. And he tells us where he thought they were in relationship to where they were in the 4th century in his particular time. Let me just mention, this source is very useful because actually there are 6 things that he mentions in the source. Now, first of all, he gives a word-for-word quote from the Bible as to the reference of the Bible. He not only mentions the quote, he actually quotes it for us. He doesn't just give us the reference. He gives us a word-for-word quote. Then he tells us where it was located with respect to a tribe, if it's in the Old Testament, or with respect to a provincial boundary, if it's in the New Testament. Galilee, for example, being divided in Upper and Lower Galilee. You had Judea, Samaria, Perea, etc. He tells us where the New Testament sites are located with respect to those particular areas. Third thing that he does is to summarize the historical material that occurred there. He doesn't quote all of it. He just gives a summary of what occurred there. Now, the reason these things are important is because there are a number of places which are identical. In the Old Testament, there are many places called Mitzvah. There are many places called Ramah. And he wants us to understand just which Ramah he's talking about. Is he talking about the one north of Jerusalem, or is he talking about the one in Galilee? Is he talking about there's a Beersheba or Beersheba? There's a Beersheba down south, there's a Beersheba up north. Which one is he talking about? So that's why he gives us a word-for-word quote of the source. He tells us where it's located with respect to the tribe, and that way we can differentiate between northern and southern areas. And he summarizes the events that are associated there. But the other thing, too, the fourth thing that he does is he gives us quotes from other sources to boot. For example, he'll use Josephus and tell us what Josephus said about this particular area. Fifth thing, he includes in his discussion where he thinks the site is located in his time. That is, in the 4th century. And the way he does this is by giving distances along roads. Now, if somebody could just flick on the projector and back, the advantage of doing this to us is the fact that he gives us the distances with respect to Roman mileposts. Here's a Roman milepost. A number of these have been found in Israel. And on the Roman milepost, you'll have Latin and Greek. What the Romans did was divide the land of Israel into various sections, and there was kind of a district capital, various districts, and there were district capitals in each of these sections, in each of these districts, and the mileposts had writing on them. They just didn't have a number on them. They would have in Greek and in Latin what district capital you were leaving if you were moving away from it. Let's say you were in the Jerusalem, called Ai at the time, was a district capital, and as you move away from Ai, you would find a milepost that would say you're now 5 Roman miles from Aelia. Roman mile was a little bit more than 9/10 of our own mile. And it would say you are X number of miles from Aelia. And then as you would continue towards another boundary, let's say down to Nicopolis, let's say you're moving a little bit towards the northwest of Israel, of Jerusalem, there would be another district, and the capital of that particular district, let's say, would be Nicopolis. And as you began to move across the boundary, the mileposts would say no longer that you're X number of miles from Jerusalem, but that you're Y number of miles from the next district capital, let's say Y miles from Nicopolis. Now, if these Roman milestones can be found, such as they are here, and a number of them have been found, if they are near their location, they help us figure out where the boundaries are located. They not only help us figure out where the boundaries are located, but knowing where the mileposts are located then helps us understand the onomasticon, Eusebius's onomasticon, better. So therefore, studying that material and knowing where these mileposts are located gives us a fairly accurate picture of where Eusebius thought it was, the site was located. The mileposts actually, and this one has been broken a little bit down below. You can see it's kind of a round column. It had a square base, and then there was even another base that was missing from this one that was put upon. So actually it would sit up about 1.5 times the height of this particular person. And this particular person actually is kind of short. He came up to about my chin. But anyway, he's pointing to a few Greek letters there. This was found on the road from Jerusalem down to Eleutheropolis, which was another district capital. And again, these milestones become very important and very useful to us. Again, Eusebius is a secondary source, but it is important secondary material. And then the other thing too, the final thing that Eusebius gives us, which makes him so useful to us, aside from the 5 things that I mentioned, the final thing that he gives us is the modern name of the site, not only the biblical name of the site, but the modern name in the 4th century. And he tells us whether pagans lived there, or Christians, or Jews. He tells us of remains at the site, whether there were churches, tombs, monumental buildings, other sites of note, etc. And I think you can understand why Eusebius then becomes a fairly important person for the study of historical geography. Now, when you take Eusebius's material and put it together, you get what's listed number 4 here, the so-called Metemma map. Have a copy of it over here. There's also a copy of it in the Israel Atlas that's upstairs in the library if you want to read the material associated with it. The second slide, however, I believe has a part of it on it. Basically, what I've done here is just show the area of Jerusalem. This particular slide is centered right around Jerusalem, showing us the main cardo, main road that goes from Jerusalem. By the way, east is up on this particular map. It's not north. The ancients would pick out sites by facing the rising sun and then telling us whether they were on the right, which would be south, towards the back, or towards the sea, which would be west, on the left, towards the north, and then towards the sun would be east. And east is pointing up here. This is the northern gate of Jerusalem, and there's a pillar here. And it is presumed that the miles were actually marked out from this pillar that exists now at the modern Damascus Gate that you find in Jerusalem. Not only do you have this pillar, but you also see a number of pillars, somewhat idealized, as you go down the street. And the interesting thing is now recent archaeological excavations in Jerusalem have also revealed the basis of these pillars. So this particular map seems to be fairly accurate. You notice that all the buildings, you're looking at them from the side, from the eastern, you're actually looking at it from the west, so you're seeing the western side looking towards the east, except for this building, which looks a little funny and kind of draws your attention to it. The reason it does that is because that is where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is located, the traditional site for the crucifixion of Christ, and so the building is put backwards as though, even though all the other buildings, you're looking at the back, you're looking at the front of this particular building, and this matches the site where the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is located today. So you have quite a bit of detail concerning Jerusalem. By the way, this is a mosaic. Each one of the little colors, each one of the little squares is a separate stone. But the other thing that this map does is give us a rough location of a number of sites throughout Israel. And the interesting thing is it matches up fairly carefully with the material that we find in Eusebius' Onomasticon. There are some differences, however. It has been proposed recently that the material both in Eusebius and also in the Medeba map may actually come from some earlier Jewish sources. It seems fairly clear that Eusebius is consulting something and probably has a road map available at that particular time, as he's not only looking on the map, but also maybe counting off the mile markers. At any rate, what we may be seeing here is the accumulation of a number of earlier sources. So these are actually the main items under the historical sources, both primary and secondary, which helps us in historical geography. The second discipline is geography itself, and that's fairly self-explanatory. Thing, however, that you have to watch is the geographical material has to be scrutinized very carefully. And here's where some language studies come in to help us. For example, we read that the border, as it goes from Ai to Bethel, goes along the shoulder of Bethel. Now, what does the word shoulder mean? It's the same word that means shoulder on a person. Does it mean the slope of the hill upon which Bethel sits? Does it mean a ridge that actually comes out from Bethel? Did it follow that and then go off to the wadi, to the dry riverbed? When it talks about the shoulder of Ekron, again, Ekron turns out to be kind of a longish site. Is it the site itself that it's talking about, or is it the ridge that comes in from Ekron? So even just looking at the geographical material, quite a bit of detail has to be examined in looking at that to boot. The third discipline, and maybe, again, an extremely important discipline, is toponymy, or the study of place names. People in the land of the Bible, as you find in other places, tend to congregate around specific sites, specific locations. And even though these locations are destroyed, there are a number of things about the location which make them ideal for subsequent peoples to come and inhabit the same site. Now, what are some of these things? First of all, security. A lot of the sites are located upon hills, at least during the Old Testament period. This is a shot. We're very fortunate this particular morning. Get a picture of the ancient site of Gibeon. Kind of a classic tell, an old mound that has a number of occupation levels. It's called a tell. If all the material is buried, if you have material sticking up from the top, it's called a hirbet. And those two terms are used today. This is a tell, actually a modern site of Jib on the back side of it, but the Old Testament site of Gibeon, where Joshua had the battle against those who were trying to take the Gibeonites, occurred right here. It's in a very important, very strategic area north of Jerusalem. Again, if I may just put a plug, a little bit more of the propaganda. When you read that Joshua leaves Ai, and as he's leaving Ai, the Gibeonites come down to Jericho, and they want to make a treaty with him. And you find that the king of Jerusalem and the king of Lachish and Hebron and Eglon are very upset. And they come to make an attack upon Gibeon. And again, it's easy to read that and to say, well, so what? But if you understand the geography of that particular area, you realize that Gibeon turns out to be an extremely important point on the crossroads, a major road that comes up from the west, and also a major north-south route that goes by Jerusalem, up past Gibeon, on north towards Shechem. And so the king of Jerusalem is very upset because all of a sudden, if the Gibeonites capitulate to Joshua, then that whole area, strategic area north of Jerusalem, is going to be open, and the next thing the invaders are going to be coming down to is Jerusalem. So again, just a plug for the geography. But one thing that you find that you're looking for a site is security, and in times past, people went up on the top of a hill, put a wall around it, and that was their secure site. That is Gibeon. Here is Beth Shan, the ancient site of Beth Shan. Later on, the Roman city expanded quite an area, and you have a Roman theater over here. Some excavations on the top. Notice the steep slopes. Too bad there isn't a car or a bus on there, and you can understand why the Israelites, after spying out the land, came back and said that we were like grasshoppers to the inhabitants of the land when we saw their cities that reached up into the heavens. Perhaps an indication of that is here, the ancient site of Lachish, this area. You can see some of the trees nearby. Again, it gives you a perspective that these are not small mounds. A number of the cities are. But these major cities, these major centers that the Israelites had to attack were major mounds. And as a result of the strategic value of these mounds, they tend to be used over and over and over again. So some people went to extremes. Perhaps some of you saw the Masada series that was on the television. There we go. This is kind of an island rock. This is the ramp that was built by Silva, the Roman general. Again, the name of the game is security. Perhaps familiar with with Masada, might not be as familiar with the Herodium. Here's where Herod the Great took a hill that was about this high, took another hill that's off the screen to the right, carved it down, and then took the material and added up on top. Again, trying to get some security. And he takes and he puts his palace right on the top of it. It looks a little bit like a volcano. There's a closer shot of it. Again, all for security. Another thing that you would like to have is water. So areas where you find springs are areas where you find continuous settlements in the land of Israel. Not every place is fortunate enough to be at the base of Mount Hermon, where you have quite a number of powerful springs coming out. This is the site of Dan up to the north at the base of Mount Hermon. Another shot of it. You can see the river coming along here. Nice wooded area. This is what the water looks like. This water comes up straight from the ground at Tel Dan. The Danites originally lived to the west of Jerusalem, down in the lowlands, right along a main invasion caravan route. They couldn't drive out the Amorites, so they said nuts to it. They moved up north. This is what they moved to. Which is fine, but then when the Assyrians and the Syrians started coming down, the Danites were the first ones to get it. So they enjoyed it for a while at least. Another view, this is right at the spring. The water is literally coming up out of the ground. As I say, not every site is fortunate enough to have this, so some ingenious modes are used. Here, by the way, just up the street a little bit, is the ancient site of Panias, called Banias today, Caesarea Philippi. And again, you can see the water just pouring out here from the springs. Here it is at sunset. This is where the god Pan was worshipped. And it's interesting that it is here in this heathen area that Peter declares Jesus, the Son of God. Water, very important. Sometimes people weren't as lucky. They had to dig some rather deep water channels, such as you find here at Hatzor. Same thing at Megiddo. This is kind of interesting. There was a spring down here And there was access to it for the fields on the outside. But when an invader came, that would be blocked off. And then people went down in through here from on top. Go down to the bottom, and there was a tunnel then which took water from the spring and led it inside the city wall. So the individuals inside the city could obtain water without being exposed. Here's the couple of Canaanites inside the water tunnel there. Carved out of solid rock. Third thing that you want is agriculture. You've got to grow a little food. This is interesting because notice what's being yoked together here. An ox and a donkey, something that was not supposed to be done by the Israelites. This, by the way, eventually rain would come. He's breaking up the soil. It's a much better farm area than what it looks like here. And finally, you like to be along some kind of a road, preferably not too major, because then not only do you get caravans coming along, but you also get armies coming along. Here's one of the main roads leading up from the up to the hill country, and also here the famous Megiddo Pass leading into the Jezreel Valley. Like so. Well, these are the four things that you have that make a site attractive. And as a result of these four things being fairly constant in Israel, you find that people tended to stick to these various localities. And as a result, you have quite a bit of continuous population. These are the factors that lead to a continuous population in a locality. However, there are some problems. We're trying to locate these sites, and the problems, I basically have five things listed here. Sites along borders and invasion routes. Basically, if an invader comes in, he may wipe out the site and then call it by a different name when he repopulates it. So you have a name change that can occur as a result of a different invader coming in. And if the different invader does not even speak the same kind of language, if he is a non-Semitic invader, then you might find great changes in the name, and hence finding the site becomes difficult. You have name changes due even to the local inhabitants. You find this happening even in the scripture itself. For example, Dan was renamed from the city of Laish, which is up to the north. And the Mari text referred to it as Laish from the 18th century. The Bible calls it Dan, and it tells us that it was Laish. You have Kiryat Arba. Some people called it Kiryat Arba, some people called it Hebron. An example that I'll show later on, Kiryat Sefer. Some people call it Kiryat Sefer, other people called it Debir. So you have even changes along those lines, and maybe not all of them are recorded, which again makes it difficult then to find where the place is located. Language changes. I brought that up under the first thing. Basically, changes that occur in the language as you go from one language group to another. For example, if you take the Egyptians called the land of Israel by the name of Retenu. Let me just write the consonants, RTN. But you have different values. For example, the R, the scribes in Egypt would use the same symbol for R, and they would also use the same symbol for L. They would use the same symbol for the D and for the Z. And the N remains the same. Now, do we put this together as Retenu? Do we put this together as a similar Hebrew word, Rotnim, which means rulers? Meaning that there were independent rulers in Israel, and that's why it's called Retenu by the Egyptians? Do we put it together as LDN? Which then would be similar to Lod, a city in Israel. Do we put it together as LZN, which would be the city Luz, or Bethel, which was a major city at that particular time? See, these are some of the problems that you have to keep fighting as you go from one language to another to try to figure out where the sites are located. You also find certain scribal corruptions that take place. And by that I mean just in the transmission of the scripture itself. The scribes did not copy things with 100% accuracy. They were not Xerox machines. And you find certain corruptions that creep in along those lines. And then you have what I call the Hellenistic Roman creep. It's not a disease. Basically, it's the following. During the Hellenistic period and on, the area in Israel became rather safe. And as a result, the people began to leave the heights, the hills, and began to settle in the valleys. But they would continue to call the city by the name of the original city up on the hill. So later on, you might come along and you see a city, hear of a city that sounds very much like a biblical site. However, that may not be the place of the biblical site. The biblical site may actually be someplace up on the hill that is near it. And how do you determine that, we'll get into in a few minutes. Now, some of the linguistic considerations, the way names change. Basically, what happens today, people who look for biblical sites, they'll go to Israel and they'll talk to the neighboring Arabs. Because the Arabic preserves the name of the site. Once you understand certain linguistic changes that happen between Hebrew and Arabic. And I've just given a number of the things here, like letter changes, the sh sound to a s sound. Like Beersheba, Beersheba. Beersheba turns out to be Beersaba. You notice there are two things that are changing names. The V sounds become the B sound and the sh sounds become a sound. This is very common. There's a tendency to lengthen O vowels. So instead of Akko, you have Akka. Instead of Ono, you have Anna. These things are well understood. Panyas, the thing that comes out underneath the 118, that doesn't come out too much. The first one is Panyas, P-A-N-I-A-S. Today is Banyas, B-A-N, it should be Y-A-S. But again, the T, B sound is something which is well attested. Sometimes you find names that drop prefixes or subformatives. Gibeon, the example that I showed, just becomes Jib. Here you have a G going to a J sound, again, which is fairly common. And rather than go through each one here, you can look at them yourself. The only one I do want to bring out, for example, is number 4 and number 5, where you have a transliteration, or translation rather. Dan in Hebrew means judge. And the city of Dan, which I showed by the Arabs, is called Tel El Kadi, the ruin of the one who judges. And there is just a direct translation of Dan to Kadi. And then also Hippas means horse. And Susita is the Hebrew form, Arabic form for horse. So Hippas, a New Testament site, is called Tel Susita. So you find a correlation there. And 5, euphemism. Basically, sites like Ophrah, Ephraim, have a root that means demon in Arabic. And the Arabs would not like to live in a city that has the name, the root meaning of the name, meaning demon. So they will change it rather to something that means good or favorable. And therefore, you find this this changing. By the way, you find the same thing in Job. Remember, Job made sacrifices because he was afraid that his children cursed God. But when you look in the Hebrew, it's not the word curse, it's the word bless. Because the scribe couldn't think of writing a curse and God next to one another. Same sort of thing that's happening here, a euphemism that is being used. And then sometimes the hardest thing is number 7, where there's no correlation whatsoever, and there you just have to depend on the archaeology and the geographical sources. Now, in this particular material, here's where the early explorers help us, and many of the maps that they made, because during the 19th century, by the way, these people will discuss in a new book that has come out, The Rediscovery of the Holy Land in the 19th Century. Discusses quite a number of the explorers who came into the land, some looking for biblical sites, some of them, like the Survey of Western Palestine, just trying to survey the land. And 2 of the more important explorers, you find Edward Robinson, not the movie actor, but rather somebody who taught in Union Seminary, along with one of his students, Eli Smith, who was an excellent linguist, came here over a number of years in the middle of the 1800s looking for biblical sites. And Eli Smith was able to take the Arabic name and take it apart and to see how it tied together with the biblical name, with the Hebrew name. And a good bit of his material, in fact, all of it, is not, you can find older copies of his work. Becomes a prime source. The reason these people are important is because the Israelis, once they figure out what the Hebrew name is, or think they know where the site is located, cease to put it as the Arabic name ceased to list it under the Arabic name on their maps, they put it down in the Hebrew form. They may or may not be right. But as somebody who does historical geography will want to go back to the Arabic form. And hence, the material that you have from Robinson, and also Survey of Western Palestine by Condor and Kitchener. This is Kitchener as a young man who did quite a bit of surveying. The list of names, the list of towns, the archaeological remains that they give become, well, it's secondary material for historical geography, but it's very important secondary material for historical geography. Now, the third discipline, and this I'll try to go through very quickly, is, or rather the fourth one, is archaeology. Both excavations and also surveys that you find. Here are some excavations. Very few of the sites in Israel have been excavated. But excavation at one site does do something very important, and that is it ties together the material remains, the shape of the pottery, with the historical sources. This is Jericho, with the famous cut here, where some very early material was found, made by Kathleen Kenyon. Here it is a little closer. Top view of Hatzor up to the north, which did much to establish the pottery up in the north part of Israel, because this was excavated in a very detailed fashion, so detailed, as a matter of fact, that only a few layers can be done this way and only a few parts of the tell. Hatzor is a major site in Israel. It's about 215 acres in area. Sites in Mesopotamia are much larger than this. And Yigael Yadin, who did the excavating here, said that to do a site entirely in Mesopotamia with the detailed work that they did at Hatzor would take about 6,000 years. It's a little hard to find funding for 6,000 years these days. Therefore, as a result, you don't have a whole lot of archaeology done. You can't go in and do a whole site. They tried to do this at Megiddo. They spent 10 years, they peeled off 4 out of 22 layers and tried cataloging everything. Then again, the money problem, the time problem. So what you do is you try to do as much as you can of a major site in order to get the stratigraphy, in order to tie together the material remains with a site where you feel you understand the history fairly well. And the history of Hatzor is understood fairly well. Then at other sites, when you come across the same kind of material, then you can date that particular site. As you get down closer, this, by the way, is a picture of the Solomonic Wall. This is one of the cities that was fortified by Solomon, along with Gezer and Megiddo. And in all three of those sites, Solomonic gates and walls have been found. Here's just the foundations of it. Up here is the palace area. I'm sorry, the storehouse area in Ahab's time. There's the greeter of the gate. You can see that these were fairly massive foundations. This is just the base of the wall. And then from there, as I said, you can get a certain stratigraphy, and then you can use this to date other sites. Sometimes when you can't do an excavation, in fact, that's most of the time, what you wind up doing is a survey. Here's a very important survey that was done in the West Bank, this area here, broken up into various sections, along with the Golan after the 67 war when Israel came across it, came in possession of the land, and quite a bit of survey work is done. And basically what the surveyor does is just find surface pottery, surface remains, sherds. However, it is not just the material itself, the whole vessel that tells you what time period it is from. You can also tell just by looking at fragments of a vessel, for example, a handle, the bottom of a jug, maybe some inscription that is on it, and you may only find a section of this, but this will also give you an idea of the time period from which it came. And the assumption is that if this material is scattered on the surface of a site, then it is the kind of material that you would also find if you excavated the site. It doesn't tell you about what monumental buildings must be there, but at least gives you occupation levels. And this has all been done for a number of areas in the country. Now, basically, the archaeology helps as follows. Remember what I said concerning sites that move. Well, a historical geographer who goes to Israel looking for a place, pins down the geography, goes to the area, and sees what the Arabic name is for the various sites, And then, to see whether the site has been pinpointed or not, we'll do an archaeological survey of the site. Let's take an example. There's a city to the north of Jerusalem, which is called Michmash in the scriptures. It is a place where Jonathan fought. The Arabic town there is called Muhmas. Michmash, Muhmas. That's similar enough to feel that that is where it's located. It's located in the right area, and the name similarity is close enough to feel that Muhmas is Michmash. However, an archaeological survey that was done in the area did not give us Iron Age material right at the site of Muhmas. A nearby hill, however, had quite a bit of Iron Age material. In fact, it had Middle Bronze material, it had Iron Age material, and then later on some Roman and Byzantine material, whereas the actual site produced only material from Roman Byzantine times, which is much, much later. As a result, then, the historical geographer will say the actual site, the original site, is on the hill where the archaeological remains were found, which correspond to the period of time when I expect the site to have existed, and not exactly at the place where the name is located. So, just by summary then, basically what you do then is the following. Rather than put a diagram on the board, well, let me put a diagram on the board. Maybe this will be a little easier. In the interest of time, I will save the examples for those that have the time to stay and give an opportunity for others who have other commitments to go. Basically what you do is the following. Here's your historical source. And the historical source gives you a number of things. It tells you the geographical location. It tells you the name or the toponym of the site. It also tells you the history of the site. All these three things are found in the geographical source, in the historical source. From the geography, you take the geography and you tie that together with just the physical geography of the region where you think it's located. In other words, you know it's north of Jerusalem. You know in the stories, 1 Samuel 12 through 14, the story of Jonathan and the Philistines. You know it's north of Jerusalem. You know it's north of Gibeon and of Saul. You know it's in an area a little bit over towards the east. You have an idea where that area is located. So you knowing the physical geography of the region and what the geographical information that we have from the historical source, we tie these things together and we make a proposal. Proposal for a site. Then from that proposal, we take the name from the historical source and we tie that together with a proposal. In other words, we have various locations where we think the site might be located, but then we use the principles of toponymy to take our first proposal and the name and make a further proposal. Or further refinement, perhaps I should say. Now, let me just take this up over here. Here's a history which corresponds to that. Here's our refinement. We now come and we take our refined proposal along with the archaeological material and we tie that together with a history. Basically, we see if the archaeological material, if the survey or the excavation shows us the kind of occupation level which ties in with the history given to us by our source material. And then at that point, does it agree? If the answer is yes, that probably is the site. If the answer is no, it's back to the drawing board. But this is basically the process which the historical geographer uses. So Let me summarize again. There are four disciplines. You have to study the sources, not only the biblical sources, but also the sources of surrounding areas, in order to get the history, the names, and the geographical locations of the sites. You tie that then together with the geography, a knowledge of the land and what makes it function, major routes, major settlement patterns, etc., tribal areas. You have to tie that together with the toponymic material, that is the change in names or the transmission of names from the biblical material to the local inhabitants through time. And then fourth, you look at the archaeology to see if your site really has an occupation level that matches when you expected the people to be there. And when all these things come together, then you have a reasonable, a high assurance that the site is really the site mentioned in the scripture. As statistics, there are about 475 sites that are mentioned in the Old Testament. About 55% of them are known. About 55%. Fair confidence. Let's say 90% confidence level. And interestingly enough, about 40% of the sites, 40 out of the 55, are found primarily through tracing down the name, toponymics. So it really is a very important aspect of historical geography. Now, this is a good exercise in itself, but getting back to the original question, how does this help us enjoy Joshua? Basically, by digging into the names, recognizing these areas, their strategic importance, the history behind them, and then these areas that normally are glossed over in reading the scripture actually become fun, believe it or not. And I would encourage you to take a look at the bibliography and look at some of these sources, and I think you'll enjoy reading them. So let's do it this way then. Those of you who have to leave, feel free to do so. Those of you who want to stay, I want to give one example. I was going to give two examples, but I don't want to do Bethel Beitin because David Livingston's going to be here next semester to speak about that. And it would be impolite to bring it up now. But I want to do Debir Rabud as an example where all four of these things tie together. So, but anyway, I will end now. Let's take about a 3-minute break, give my voice a break, give your ears a break, and then those who want to stay and look at the specific examples are welcome to do so. As far as an example, David Livingston will be here, and there's quite a discussion that is going on between him and Anson Rainey concerning the location of Ai. And the reason he wants to relocate Bethel is really because he wants to relocate Ai, because the traditional site for Ai, the problem with that, the Ai that was conquered by Joshua, does not contain, of all the excavations that have been carried out there, no material has been found from the so-called late Bronze period, from the period of time which corresponds archaeologically to the historical period of the conquest, whether you believe in the conquest that occurred early in the 15th century or later in the 13th century, it is not there. But knowing how historical geographers go about naming sites, I think you'll enjoy reading the material on the last page of the bibliography. I would really suggest these references before David Livingston comes. I don't know if there's a date yet for sure as to when he's coming. Has one been set up? It would be good to look at this. All the materials from the Westminster Theological Journal and is readily available upstairs. And then some examples of site identification. I've given example works on the back. I don't know what you may have heard about Anson Rainey here, but when it comes to geography, he is really very good. And I hope any prejudice that have arisen concerning him, that you can sort of put those aside and just read his material for the historical geography. I think you will find it very useful. Now, what I want to do is go over a neat resolution to a problem in Scripture. In fact, maybe even a couple of them. This will take about 5-10 minutes. Basically, the location of Debir, The location of Debir. Debir was a rather major site south of Hebron. And the material for it is given to us both in Joshua and in the first chapter of Judges. Let me just read that. And we're going to go through this now, looking at the historical source, finding out what material we have in the historical source, trying to tie it together with the geography and with the archaeology, and see how it all fits together. In the very first chapter of Judges, we have the conquest of the Debir by Caleb's clan. And I said, this is also in Joshua 15, 13 and following. I'm reading from the Judges passage. This is Judges 1, 9. After that, after the men of Judah had attacked Jerusalem, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country, the Negev. The Negev is to the south, the western foothills. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriat Arba. Here's the name change that we find even in the scripture that I mentioned before. And defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there, they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriat Sefer. And Caleb said, I will give my daughter Aksah in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriat Sefer, or Debir. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksah to him in marriage. One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, what can I do for you? And she replied, do me a special favor. Since you have given me land in the Negev. Now, Negev means south. The word itself means dry. And as you get south of Hebron, it begins to get dry very quickly. So the word dry then becomes the general word for south as well. And she says, since you have given me this area and this dry land, give me also springs of water. You kind of get the idea that the springs of water are not right at Kiriat Sefer, or they're not right at Debir, because she's asking for something that's outside of that vicinity, because her husband, Othniel, already has that. She says, give me some springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. And that's our story. Now, where is this located? Look at Joshua chapter 15, verse 49. Again, we try to tie together the geographical, historical material. These are sections of Judah. In verse 48, these are cities that were in the hill country. Shamir, Jatir, Sokol, Dana, Kiriat Sana. Here's a third name now. We have Debir, Kiriat Sefer. Here's now Kiriat Sana. And then they say that is Debir, Anab, Eshtemoa, Anin, etc. Where is it located? In the hill country. Now, perhaps the best way to show that would be over here. On this particular map, these divisions between hill country and the lowlands and the plain and the wilderness are fairly distinct in Scripture. And when the writer says the hill country, he really means the hill country here. He doesn't mean down here in the Shephelah. Shephelah is just the lowlands, or the western foothills, as it's translated in the NIV. If he means western foothills, if he says Shephelah, he means Shephelah. He doesn't mean the hill country, etc. Now, when William Foxwell Albright, who also has made some major contributions in looking for sites, was looking for Debir, he was looking for a site that would have archaeological remains from the period of the conquest. He himself believing in a late conquest, coming in the 13th century B.C. He had dug a site in the western foothills by the name of Tel Beit Mirsim. And at Tel Beit Mirsim, he found material from the late Bronze period, which corresponds to the conquest, and he also found two large wells. And so he felt this must be Debir. There's a major problem with that, however, because Debir is supposed to be in the hill country. But Albright said in his surveys of the hill country around Hebron that there was no late bronze material in the hill country. Therefore, he's looking for a place that fits the material here as closely as possible, and he chose Tel Beit Mirsum, which is actually to the west of where De Beer is really located. After the 67 war, in a number of the shops, pottery shops, antique dealers in Jerusalem, quite a bit of material started showing up as the people in the West Bank began bringing it in and found its way into Jerusalem proper. And a number of the archaeologists tried to trace down where this material was showing up. And some material that was showing up was from the late Bronze period. And people said it came from the hill country. And a man by the name of Moshe Kohavi, I've listed the reference again under the special works in the bibliography, found a place called Rabud from where the material was coming. Rabud. Let me just show it briefly on the map that I have up here. Kirbet Rabud. There is also a little village here. And here's Rabud, Rabda, Rabia. These names are very similar, and you would think that perhaps it's the same route that is given these names. This is the main road coming down from Hebron. Hebron would be up here. The road splits. An older road that is not used now goes down to Arad, and then continues on down to the southern part of the Dead Sea. North is straight up. And then this particular road continues down to Beersheba, past, again, a modern site called Naharia. This is Kirbet Rabud. The crosshatch area is the place where people still live. And in a hill that's just a little bit to the east, there were a number of tombs, and presumably, or apparently rather, this late bronze material was coming from that area. So soon after the war, in kind of a salvage operation, because the site was being used for agriculture, turns out that these sites, with the material as it decays, provides nutrients, and the people like to use them for agriculture. After the war, he, along with students from the American Institute of Holy Land Studies, went and made a salvation dig. They cut across the hill, along the slope of the hill, they made a slice to see if they could find a wall. And lo and behold, they found material, they found a wall and a number of material from the late bronze period. Again, this should ring a bell. This is conquest. The other thing, so archaeologically, the site fits very nicely. But linguistically, how do we get Rabud from De Beer? Well, again, if you look at the consonants, R, BD, Rabud, what is De Beer? DBR. A metathesis has taken place. And the inhabitants just switched the names around. So now you have linguistic evidence as well that this is where De Beer is located. You have it in the hill country where it's supposed to be. Linguistically it fits, archaeologically it fits. And remember the two wells that were given? Over here, you have Biril Alak Elfoka, Biril Alak Et Taktani. Now, Bir just means well. There is a valley, as you can see from the contours, that follows from Kirbet Rabud very nicely. Those wells are still used today. Two wells outside of the vicinity of the city, because again, if they were right in the city or near the city, Otniel would have had them already. He wouldn't have to ask Caleb for them. This whole area was given to Caleb as an inheritance. Interestingly enough, the word Foka is the Arabic word for upper well. This, by the way, is the upper well of the leeches and the lower well of the leeches. It's not totally appetizing, but the water's good, so the natives use it. Interestingly enough, this is the kind of the classical Arabic form for upper. There is a colloquial Arabic form for upper that matches the upper well, that matches the word, the Hebrew word, Elyon, which means upper. And interestingly enough, the locals there call the upper word by the colloquial Arabic, which matches the Hebrew, rather than by the classical Arabic. Taktani is very close to the Hebrew Tachat, the lower well, so there's no change there. Foka The Arabs, classical Hebrew, but the locals use a word that is closer to the Hebrew, colloquial Arabic. So, when you look at all things and tie all these things together, it is interesting to see how everything fits at this point. All the various disciplines that have been mentioned fit very nicely at this point. And also, another thing too, and that is, the biblical material, again, it shows in this particular case how seriously the biblical writer is when he lists cities and sites. He writes them as somebody who knows where they are, who has lived there at the time, who knows where they are and relates to us where they are. And if our site comes up different than where the scripture puts it, then the best thing is to hold off and try to investigate a little more rather than to say just so much worse for the scripture. Now, interestingly enough, Albright was taken by Kohavi to this area in order to look at the sites, and he still remained unconvinced to his dying day. And the argument that he brought up was the following. If you look at the division of the land of Judah at this point, you find various districts, as given here by the dotted lines. Over here, in this particular district, you have Debir, which is mentioned as a district capital. And Albright objected to Debir being here. Here's Tel Beit Mirsim, where he wanted it. The reason he objected to Debir being in this location is because Duma, which is the district capital here for the sixth region, is so close. And he says it's absurd to have two district capitals that close together. But as Kohavi has shown, upon looking at this area a little more closely, these divisions follow right along watersheds, interestingly enough. This particular watershed, separating the central area from the water, this water flows south towards Beersheba. This water flows east towards the Dead Sea. This water flows west towards the Mediterranean. And what those who divided this area into districts did was to follow the watershed very carefully. Again, it shows how seriously these people took their geography. And since this is a division, a watershed division, the fact that Duma is close to the Beer really doesn't mean anything. There's a distinct break there, a distinct ridge that divides one region from the other. So again, everything ties together so beautifully here. I think it's just a classy example of how all these disciplines come together at this one point. Just a last thing, too, that's interesting. If you take a look at another problem down on the bottom, Bethel Beitin, as I said, note the Livingston-Rainey exchange, Debir Abud, we just did, New Testament Jericho. If you look at the Matthew and Mark passage, when Jesus is going on his last ascent, this is page 2 of the outline, not of the bibliography, on the very bottom of the page. Here's where, again, some geography can help overcome a seeming contradiction in the scripture. When Jesus is going up to Jericho for the last time, when Jesus is going up from Jericho for the last time, he has come down from Galilee, he's gone down up to Jerusalem, back to Perea to spend the winter, and now he's making his final ascent up to Jerusalem knowing he's going to be crucified. And as he comes through Jericho, he heals a blind person called Bartimaeus. In Matthew and in Mark, it says that he did this coming from Jericho, and the Greek preposition apo is used, meaning from. However, in Luke, many translators say he did this near Jericho. The preposition, however, is east, which means he did this on his way into Jericho. And there are not variants there in order to think that this is just some kind of a variant, some kind of a scribal error. And hence, do we have a contradiction here, where two gospel writers say he did this coming from Jericho, and another gospel writer said he did this going towards Jericho. Here's what I see as a resolution to the problem. Here you have Jerusalem, which is sitting up quite a ways. Over here, the Dead Sea. Jericho is here. The oasis of Jericho can be outlined basically as follows. During the New Testament period, Herod the Great built his favorite palace down in Jericho. And he built it along a wadi, dry riverbed, to the south of Jericho. And what he did was to build a palace right here. And this became the political center then of the area where Herod has built his palace. It was kind of a split palace with a walkway across, hanging gardens, Roman baths, etc. The Roman road that leads up to Jerusalem that Jesus would have taken basically goes by the palace up along here and then leads on over towards Jerusalem, roughly like so. We have proposed the following, that the healing took place here, in between. Mark and Matthew, or at least Matthew, who is writing more for Jewish audiences, would think of Jericho centered around the population center. And there would be a number of Jews in Jericho, and they would be centered around the Old Testament site. It wasn't used at this particular time. It was still a village. And a number of the workers, the inhabitants, would be living here near the oasis where they would be doing their farming. And therefore, they see Jesus as leaving Jericho when he heals Bartimaeus. On the other hand, Luke, who is well acquainted with the whole system, Roman system, of provincial division and command, etc., political command, would be thinking of the political center of Jericho as centered at the palace where Herod would be located. So to Luke's mind, who interestingly enough is also, if you believe what most of the critics say, is writing for the more cosmopolitan person, the more well-educated person, let's say the more Romanized person, in his mind, the center of Jericho would be centered where the political center is located, in Herod's palace. So to Luke, Jesus is not leaving Jericho, he's entering Jericho. He's coming towards it. And may I suggest this is a resolution to the problem. I don't know, maybe you've thought about it some. But I think that's another nice geographical resolution to a seeming contradiction in the scripture.